From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Israeli forces have invaded the Gaza Strip for the first time since withdrawing 10 months ago. Israel says it's launched the raid to recover a soldier captured by Palestinian militants. The strikes come just hours after Fatah and Hamas agreed on a document to implicitly recognize Israel within its 1967 borders. We'll speak with former Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami and Palestinian activist Ali Abu Nima. Then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice arrives in Afghanistan. We'll talk with a Pakistani journalist, Ahmed Rashid, and Christian Parenti.
Violence in Afghanistan is escalating, as was predicted by many observers, and the primary fault of it is the corruption and failure of the U.S.-led occupation.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli tanks and helicopter gunships have invaded the Gaza Strip for the first time since withdrawing 10 months ago. Israel says it's launched the raid to recover captured soldier Gilad Shalit. Shalit was captured in a Palestinian operation on Sunday. The raid began after Israel rejected Shalit's captors' demand for the release of all Palestinian women and Palestinians below the age of 18 in Israeli prisons. Israel opened the attack with a series of airstrikes on three bridges and Gaza's main power station. The attack left the power station in flames and knocked out electricity in most of Gaza City. Palestinian militants have reportedly taken up defensive positions around Gaza, setting the stage for a potential firefight with the invading soldiers. We'll have more from Gaza in a few minutes. A major new report on electronic voting has concluded the three most common types of electronic voting machines are all vulnerable to software attacks. The study by the Brennan Center for Justice concluded a single person with technical knowledge could alter the outcome of an election by tampering with the software. The study is considered the most comprehensive ever done on electronic voting machines. The report calls for electronic voting machines to produce voter-verifiable paper records, a ban on wireless components on all voting machines, new safeguards to detect software attacks, as well as routine audits. In news from Iraq, the United Nations is estimating 150,000 Iraqis have been displaced from their homes in the past 4 months due to increased fighting. The mass displacement began after the bombing of a Shiite shrine in Samarra in February. Meanwhile, the U.S. military has acknowledged the security situation has barely improved in Baghdad despite a two-week security clampdown involving 75,000 Iraqi and U.S. troops. On Tuesday, at least 18 people died in Iraq, including a U.S. Marine and three U.S. soldiers. In Russia, lawmakers have lashed out at the United States following the killing of four Russian hostages in Iraq. By a unanimous vote, Russia's lower house of parliament approved a resolution that decried the killings and criticized the occupying countries in Iraq for losing control in the country. The resolution said the abduction of the hostages occurred because of the deepening crisis in Iraq, where terror and violence are becoming the order of the day there. In Mexico, presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador is expected to hold a massive campaign rally today in Mexico City ahead of Sunday's election. Under Mexican law, candidates must stop campaigning tonight. The latest polls show the populist López Obrador has a slight lead over the conservative Felipe Calderón. López Obrador has been running on a progressive platform calling for greater aid to the poor, free medical care, and food subsidies for the elderly. The rewriting of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the end to the further privatization of the country's oil and gas industries. Meanwhile, Calderón has received the strong backing of the business community. During a campaign stop Tuesday, Calderón warned that López Obrador would ruin Mexico's economy.
Mexico already lived through these lies, the deception that they want to bring on the people. I tell you, friends, the terrible story cannot be repeated. The cost of the government's debt that our children will pay, and the final economic crisis that the poorest among the poor has paid. I tell you, friends, this is not the path. The path is from this side. This path is the one that guarantees economic stability and growth and investment to generate jobs.
Mexican presidential candidate Felipe Calderón. Meanwhile, Andres López Obrador rejected the accusation.
No va a suceder nada.
Nothing is going to happen. The only thing that will happen is that Mexico will no longer be a country of the privileged, that the government will no longer be a committee to serve a minority. Now the government will be for all. The country will be for all. And for this, we are in this movement, in this fight.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has rejected a proposed amendment to ban the desecration of the American flag. The Republican-led initiative fell a single vote short of passing. In other news from Washington, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter says he's seriously considering suing the White House over President Bush's use of signing statements. Bush has maintained that he has the right to revise, interpret, or disregard hundreds of laws on national security and constitutional grounds. Since his election, Bush has issued more than 750 signing statements, more than all previous presidents combined. Senator Specter raised the possibility of suing the White House during a hearing on the legality of presidential signing statements. At the meeting, Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy called the president's use of signing statements a grave threat to the nation's constitutional system of checks and balances. The U.S. Surgeon General Richard Carmona is urging lawmakers to ban smoking in all public buildings because of the dangers of secondhand smoke. The government estimates 50,000 non-smoking Americans prematurely died last year because of secondhand smoke. Carmona also urged parents to stop smoking inside their homes because he said children are especially vulnerable. Recent studies have linked secondhand smoke to heart disease and lung cancer, as well as breast cancer, childhood cancer, nasal sinus cancer, ear infections, and asthma. Scientists have also established a clear link between secondhand smoke and sudden infant death syndrome. Some tobacco companies have rejected these claims. A statement on the R.J. Reynolds website reads, quote, "It seems unlikely that secondhand smoke presents any significant harm to otherwise healthy non-smoking adults." In Tennessee, Sedley Alley was executed early this morning, becoming only the second person to be executed in Tennessee in 45 years. The New York-based Innocence Project had called for Alley's execution to be put off because the state had refused to allow DNA testing on crime scene evidence. Alley's lawyers said they would continue to press for DNA testing that they believe will show an innocent man was put to death. Alley had been convicted on raping and murdering a young Marine named Suzanne Collins in 1985. A second prisoner on Tennessee's death row, named Paul Dennis Reed, was also scheduled to be killed today, but a federal judge halted that execution. A British watchdog group called Privacy International has launched a campaign to urge European banks to stop releasing confidential financial records to the U.S. government. Last week, the New York Times revealed the Brussels-based Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications has allowed the Bush administration to secretly monitor millions of international bank transactions without court approval. Privacy International said it had filed complaints with data protection and privacy regulators in 32 countries. The Belgian prime minister has also asked the country's justice ministry to investigate whether the Bush administration's secret program violates Belgian law. Meanwhile, in Washington, Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Pat Roberts has accused the New York Times and other press outlets of acting irresponsibly by reporting on the secret program. Roberts has asked John Negroponte, the director of National Intelligence, to assess the damage the reports pose. Roberts wrote, quote, "We have been unable to persuade the media to act responsibly and to protect the means by which we protect this nation." The editors of the National Review have called for the government to strip the New York Times of its press credentials. In other news from Europe, the European Union's top justice official has acknowledged U.S. intelligence agents have kidnapped individuals inside Europe as part of a secretive program called Extraordinary Rendition. On Tuesday, the Council of Europe voted to continue investigating alleged CIA secret flights and prisons in Europe and called for safeguards to prevent human rights abuses by foreign intelligence agents and European countries. The Council also endorsed the findings of Swiss Senator Dick Marty. Earlier this month, he concluded 14 European countries have been involved in or complicit in secret CIA operations since the September 11th attacks. On Tuesday, Marty warned the Bush administration's secret operations are hurting the so-called war on terror.
En donnant By using these kinds of means, we give some legitimacy to terrorism. And moreover, we create some sympathy for terrorists. I think this sympathy is extremely dangerous. This sympathy is to terrorism what oxygen is to fire.
Code Pink, Global Exchange, and Gold Star Families for Peace have announced they'll launch a hunger strike on July 4th outside the White House to protest the war in Iraq. Dozens of military family members, veterans, activists, and celebrities have vowed to take part in the hunger strike. The list includes Cindy Sheehan, Dolores Huerta, Willie Nelson, Danny Glover, Sean Penn, and Susan Sarandon. Cindy Sheehan said in a statement, quote, "We've marched, held vigils, lobbied Congress, camped out at Bush's ranch. We've even gone to jail. Now it's time to do more," she said. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, today's top story, Israeli forces have invaded the Gaza Strip for the first time since withdrawing 10 months ago. Israel says it's launched the raid to recover captured soldier Gilad Shalit. Shalit was captured in a Palestinian operation on Sunday. The raid began after Israel rejected Shalit's captors' demands for the release of all Palestinian women and Palestinians below the age of 18 in Israeli prisons. Israel opened the attack with a series of airstrikes on three bridges and Gaza's main power station. The attack left the station in flames and knocked out electricity in most of Gaza City. Palestinian militants have reportedly taken up defensive positions around Gaza, setting the stage for a potential firefight with the invading soldiers. The strikes came just hours after officials close to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said Hamas had agreed on a document to implicitly recognize Israel within its June 1967 borders. Hamas leaders later denied this as the case. More on that agreement in a minute. We will then go to Gaza for the latest on the Israel incursion. But first, we're joined on the telephone from Spain by Shlomo Ben-Ami. He's the former foreign minister of Israel and a former member of the Israeli Knesset. He wrote the book Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, the Israeli-Arab Tragedy. We're also joined on the line by Ali Abu Nima, founder of Electronic Intifada, electronicintifada.net, speaking to us from Jordan. Ali Abu Nima, can you talk about the latest news?
Yes. Good morning, Amy. I'm here in Amman, Jordan, and watching the situation very closely. And it reminds me of the eulogy that Rabbi Yaakov Peren gave for Baruch Goldstein, the Israeli settler who murdered 29 Palestinians in Hebron in 1994. He said, 1 million Arabs are not worth a Jewish fingernail. And this kind of racism is clearly on display in the Israeli reaction to the capture of its soldier in the Gaza Strip by the Palestinian resistance. In fact, last week here in Amman, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said explicitly that the lives of Israeli Jews are more important than the lives of Palestinians. And we see that reflected also in the world reaction. Is it not astonishing that the entire world knows the name and face of the Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, while the hundreds of Palestinian children held in Israel's dungeons, not to mention 10,000 adult prisoners, thousands held without charge and trial, abducted from their homes in the middle of the night by Israeli occupation forces, remain nameless and faceless before a silent world? And I want to say that it's very deeply painful to me as a Palestinian that while Palestinians in Gaza are demonstrating, the families of prisoners are demonstrating to urge the resistance not to release the soldier until their prisoners and hostages held by Israel are released, that the Palestinian Authority chairman Mahmoud Abbas rushed to condemn the legitimate conventional military operation carried out by the resistance and rushed to send his security forces to hunt for the captured soldier on Israel's behalf, when never once in history has he deployed his forces to protect and defend his own people against Israel's daily massacres. It's becoming unavoidable to many Palestinians, if not most, that Abbas is engaged in open collaboration with the occupation. And a final point, that as far as Israel is concerned, it is rapidly becoming a failed state, unable to learn any lessons from its past. It's now repeating in Gaza and the West Bank all the mistakes of its invasion and occupation of Lebanon. And I believe that if it doesn't drastically and dramatically change course, it will self-destruct within a decade, perhaps taking everyone else in the region with it. It has become an apartheid pariah state, and its leaders are deluded in thinking that they can bludgeon the indigenous Palestinian population, who are now the majority between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, into submission and servitude. I call on brave Israelis to understand the lessons which brave white South Africans understood, and to engage in a voluntary process with Palestinians of dismantling completely, starting today, the system of racist laws, walls, and settler colonies that are imprisoning both people in perpetual and endless and escalating bloodshed. It needs to start now.
Ali Abu Nima speaking to us from Amman. Let's turn to the former Israeli foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami. Your response?
Response to what?
To what Ali Abu Nima said.
I'm not going to respond to that. If you have any particular question with regard to this operation, with regard to the abduction, with regard of the political situation on the ground, I'm not going to go into that wider analysis about South Africa and what have you.
Why don't you start with what is happening right now?
Well, what seems to me that is happening right now is that Israel is trying to change the equation that was established by those who took the soldier as hostage. Their equation was one of releasing the soldier for prisoners in Israeli jails, and Israel seems that the present government is not ready to that, although previous governments did negotiate, and Rabin negotiated, even Sharon negotiated to exchange prisoners. This government doesn't feel to be politically confident enough to negotiate, and therefore they want to change the equation and to one that means that we will withdraw from Gaza, we will stop, we will interrupt this incursion if the soldier is released. Is this going to work? I'm not sure it is going to work. I am afraid that these kind of operations tend to have a dynamic that one knows how they start, one doesn't really know how they end. I hope it doesn't end in the collapse of the Palestinian Authority, in the collapse of Abu Mazen and the rest of it, because the situation is difficult enough without this modicum of stability and legitimacy that is given by the current president and the prime minister is destroyed. So I really expect that things will be controlled in some way.
Do you think that the Israeli government should release prisoners?
Should release prisoners? Well, I think that these kind of situations require a sort of political approach rather than a military approach. You see, it's not that easy also to say that they should release prisoners, because that means that every Israeli citizen is a candidate to be taken hostage. The dilemma is not simple. I am for a political solution. This might perhaps take the form of say that the quid pro quo from the point of view of Israel would have to be not to persist in the suffocation, the economic suffocation of the Gaza Strip, the boycott to the Palestinian Authority. These kind of quid pro quos, maybe we can reach through some sort of third party mediation. I'm not sure that exchanging prisoners will work, simply because this means exposing every Israeli citizen to being taken hostage.
Do you think the Israeli government was wrong to re-invade Gaza?
Well, yes, I think it was wrong to do that, because if only for the reasons that that affect the stability of the government itself. You see, the government is engaged now in this idea of disengagement from the West Bank. If they invade the Gaza Strip, what they are going to show to the Israeli opinion and to public opinion as a whole is that disengagement, unilateral disengagement, doesn't work. If you do not coordinate things, either with the Palestinians or through a third party, the Quartet, for example, the disengagement creates a front line in a state of war, in a permanent state of war, and therefore you'll have to reoccupy the territories. So what's the point in disengaging in such a manner? I think the government is exposing the fallacies of its own policy by occupying or reoccupying the Gaza Strip.
I wanted to go to Gaza right now, where Dr. Mona Alfara is. She is a physician in northern Gaza, a health development consultant for the Union of Health Work Committees in Gaza. What is the situation on the ground right now, Dr. Alfara?
Yeah, since the early hours of the morning, the Israeli army did not stop sonic bombing against the Gaza Strip. They started the operation last night, 10:30. They targeted the infrastructure of the Gaza Strip. Two-thirds, the main target was the electrical power plant. And now, two-thirds of Gaza Strip are with no electricity. The population mood is angry, anxious, worried, scared. But despite of this, demonstrations are going in the streets against the release of the soldier, especially by the families of the political prisoners. This is the opinion, feeling. And I have a comment here to say, there's no balance of power between the Israeli army and the militia or the resistance movement here in Gaza. Israel knows that very well. So what's happening in Gaza now is collective punishment. I don't understand why to destroy the infrastructure, why to deprive the population from the electricity. It is collective punishment. It is not just, this will not bring the soldier back. What will bring the soldier back? Negotiation, understanding the rights of Palestinian people to exist. The disengagement plan, for example, and the wall in the West Bank, all these measures Israeli did to guarantee its security, it did not. Anyway, because the security of Israel is not harmed by the resistance, largely harmed by the Palestinian resistance. The mood is very, very bad in Gaza and angry. You can see 22,000 people last night demonstrated in the middle camps of Gaza Strip against the release of the soldier, or the release of the soldier in swap of the political prisoners. People feel they are humiliated. The Israel and the world wants us to kneel down. This is the mood of the people here now in Gaza.
The issue of collective punishment, Shlomo Ben-Ami, former foreign minister of Israel, your response to that?
I am not favorable to collective punishment, but you see...
Shlomo Ben-Ami.
One needs to see the conditions on the ground. When Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip, and then you have every day Qassam missiles being launched against an Israeli township, what would you do then? What is the answer to that? I mean, either to reoccupy the land or to open political negotiations, but does, for example, President Abbas or even Ismail Haniyeh control all the factions in Gaza? Do they control Islamic Jihad? Do they control the martyrs of Al-Aqsa? So you have here a very serious problem. We need sometimes to descend from the heights of the conceptual or even of the moral ground, and to see what can be done on the ground. So the problem is that the government has been trying all kinds of ways to stop the launching of Qassam missiles. I'm sure that Ismail Haniyeh is not interested in these attacks. I'm sure that Mahmoud Abbas is not interested. Do they have the capacity to stop it? They don't have it, because the political system or the hierarchy of command, the chain of command, is invertebrate. So what is Israel to do in such a situation?
Ali Abu Nima, your response.
Well, it's amazing, the rhetoric of Shlomo Ben Ami, who knows much better. I've heard him expose the situation more eloquently, even on your show, Amy. He knows very well that this isn't about Gaza. This is about Israel's relentless assault on the Palestinians throughout the occupied territories, its expansion of colonies and settlements in the occupied West Bank, and its announced annexation plan, which even he has criticized. But he's not against the annexation of the West Bank. What he believes, he's deluded in believing, is that Palestinians, they can find Palestinians who will sit and agree to the annexation of Ma'ale Adumim, Ariel, and all the settlements around the occupied territories. What he has to realize, and what all Israelis have to realize, is that the age of colonialism has ended. He said, Shlomo Ben Ami said, that the so-called convergence plan, the unilateral annexation plan, is Israel's attempt to preempt the world recognizing that Israel is now a Jewish minority ruling over a Palestinian majority. He wants to talk about the quartet and the U.S. and doing things on the ground because he doesn't want to talk about the big picture, that what is driving the conflict is the radical inequality between the Jewish minority that rules all of the territory between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River and the disenfranchised Palestinian majority who are paying the price for the luxury that Israel lives in, for the high incomes of Israelis, for the settlements, for the swimming pools, for the security in Tel Aviv and in Herzliya and in Jaffa and in Haifa and in Acre, that Israelis live a normal life all around the country, except in Sderot, where they experienced a few dozen Qassams. But what pays for that normality for Israelis is the total disenfranchisement and dispossession of the majority population. And Israel believes that it can hide them behind walls in ghettos, as was done to Jews in Europe in the 1930s and 40s. And he should be a brave Israeli. He should speak out against the occupation. He should speak out against the apartheid laws inside Israel, not just in the West Bank. He should condemn the law that says that an Israeli citizen can marry anybody in the world except a Palestinian, that an Israeli who marries a Palestinian has to leave the country. This is a new style of apartheid. It is even, as some have said, a new kind of Nuremberg law. And I'm waiting for Shlomo Ben Ami to live up to his claimed liberal and progressive credentials and condemn these things and join the struggle to liberate not just Palestinians but also Israelis from this devastating system of oppression and apartheid, which will kill all of us.
Let me put that question to Shlomo Ben Ami.
I really thought we are going to talk about the current crisis as it is.
Well, I
of course do not deny things that I said about the convergence plan. I dedicated my political life to trying to reach a settlement that essentially meant disengaging from Palestinian lands, having a fully fledged Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. These are my credentials. It's not books that I've written, it is things that I've tried to do. Now we have a political crisis there, and we are trying to see how we solve it. My suggestion is, as I said before, not to invade, try to find a different quid pro quo, and that is stopping the suffocation of the Palestinian economy in Gaza, improving relations with the authorities, with the Palestinian authorities, and moving to a political phase. This is my solution to the current crisis. I don't want to go now into the wider picture. I have said things, I have written things about it. I don't want to repeat it right now. And I, frankly, I am in the middle of a business lunch. I had the idea that we are having a very short interview.
Well, let me just ask you,
interrupting the whole reunion.
I'm very sorry. I just want to ask you one last question. The strikes coming just hours after officials close to Mahmoud Abbas said Hamas had agreed on a document to implicitly recognize Israel within its June 67 borders.
I think it is a very important document. I think that if indeed they sign it, this will at least stem the decline into a potential civil war between Palestinians. I think it is in Israel's interest to have a united Palestinian polity that subscribes to a shared political plan. I would have preferred them to simply subscribe to the Arab Peace Initiative. I think they have departed from that legitimacy, from that inter-Arab legitimacy, and created their own. I don't see the logic of it. I think that the Arab Peace Initiative has a worldwide legitimacy, and simply subscribing to it would have meant a lot in terms of Israeli public opinion. As it is, I think it enhances the unity between Palestinians, but it creates a condition that I am afraid, and again, I'm not speaking theory and not generalities, I'm afraid that the current Israeli government will not see that as a starter.
Oh, I want to thank you for being with us, Shlomo Ben-Ami, former Israeli foreign minister, member of parliament, book Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, the Israeli-Arab Tragedy. He is speaking to us from Spain. Thanks for joining us. We will come back to this discussion after break with Ali Abu Nima as well as Dr. Al-Farah. Stay with us.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. With the blood and the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear, you might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who send the gun to the wars that are fought in places where the business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, or TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own. Other people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and their lives in the balance. There are people under fire, there are children at the cannons, there is blood on the wire.
Jackson Brown, Lives in the Balance here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are talking to Ali Abu Nima, founder of Electronic Intifada, and Dr. Mona Al-Farah, physician in northern Gaza. Ali Abu Nima, your response to this document that at least those close to Mahmoud Abbas said that Hamas had agreed to recognizing Israel within the 67 borders.
I think if tomorrow Ismail Haniyeh and Khalid Mishal and all the others of leaders of Hamas get down on their knees and say, we want to give up everything to Israel and accept a state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and accept to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees, and to abandon our right to resist the occupation in any form whatsoever, it would make no difference whatsoever, Amy, because the stumbling block, the fiction here, is that it's the Palestinians who have rejected this. The Hamas leaders, like the leaders of Fatah, have said many times that they're willing to talk to Israel, they're willing to recognize Israel. The Hamas leaders have said, okay, we don't want to do that in advance because the PLO did that in advance during the Oslo Accords and got nothing in return. So we do it on the basis of reciprocity. The problem, Amy, is that Israel is still completely 100% committed to colonialism. That is why Israel is continuing to seize land in the West Bank, to build new settler colonies every day, to pave Jewish-only roads in the West Bank, to build the apartheid wall, to treat Gaza as a giant prison. The reason that Israel pulled its settlers out of Gaza, as Shlomo Ben Ami has said before, is to create the fiction that Israel is not ruling over a Palestinian majority, exactly as South Africa created the Bantustans to try and fool the world into thinking that blacks had their rights within these so-called independent homelands and didn't need to have rights within the South African state. The same trick will not work in Palestine as it did not work in South Africa, and the world needs to recognize that, and I'm thrilled that there's a growing civil society movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions that does. This is what is going to put pressure on Israel to end the colonial practices, no matter what document is signed between Hamas and Fatah. That will make no difference if there is no active worldwide opposition and resistance to Israel's colonialism. That is what will make a difference.
Dr. Mona Al-Farah, I wanted to give you the last word. And we last spoke, Shlomo Ben-Ami was talking about the shelling of Qassam. And we last spoke, Dr. Al-Farah, when you were at the hospital after the children, the families, were the explosions on the beach in Gaza, and a number of members of one family killed. What is the latest on that situation?
Okay, first, just quickly, I totally agree with the analysis of Mr. Abu Naima. Totally agree with his analysis. Israel did not find the excuse of the soldier. The plan was ready to invade Gaza. It's not physical invasion. Anyway, if they did not invade Gaza, we're controlling us from outside. Regarding the Qassam rockets, I would like to know how many people really were injured by these Qassam rockets. As I told you before, the balance of power is towards Israel. These Qassam rockets and the other rockets is just very primitive devices. It is just a show of protesting against what's happening here. But seriously, it doesn't hurt Israel security. What was your question?
The latest on the family that we last spoke to you about, that members of the family, of the Ghalia family, who were killed at the Gaza beach, and the conflicting reports, Human Rights Watch and you yourself as a doctor in the hospital saying that it was as a result of Israeli shelling, and the Israeli military saying it was Palestinian bombs.
Yeah. Okay, this is a big joke for me, and I'm totally all of us here in Gaza, totally convinced by the fact that it was Israeli shelling. I met the doctors who received the injured. I saw the injured myself, and the site of injuries show that it was not from minefields. Injuries are different from shelling injuries. The site of the injuries were in the upper side of the bodies. Besides, the shrapnels were found. It was the same like what we received in the incursion of Jabalia 2 years ago. So no matter what Israel is trying to say, it is Palestinian mines. This is not acceptable for us. And we forget all this. We don't need to add new crime to the Israeli crimes. Even this was from the Palestinian side. We have a large record of Israeli assault against Palestinian. And just I need somebody to explain to me why this sonic bombing. Now, since 3 years, o'clock in the morning till now, we are under heavy sonic bombing from the sky. This I consider collective punishment, and it will not secure Israeli security. It is just they are humiliating us as Palestinians.
They
want us to kneel down. And I again agree with Mr. Abu Naima. What Israel is doing now to revive the idea of colonialism in the area.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Dr. Mona Farah, physician, community activist in northern Gaza, and Ali Abu Naima, who is founder of electronicintifada.net. We thank you both for joining us as we turn now to Afghanistan, where the Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has just arrived for talks with Afghan President Hamid Karzai and other top officials. Speaking at a news conference in Kabul, Rice expressed strong U.S. support for Karzai, saying, quote, "I don't know anyone who's more admired and respected in the international community." Rice also said the, quote, "democratic institutions and democratic future of Afghanistan are getting stronger and stronger every day." Her comments come during one of the bloodiest months in Afghanistan since the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. U.S. and coalition forces recently launched the largest military offensive in the country since the fall of the Taliban. Fighting across southern Afghanistan has killed at least 33 people on Tuesday alone. Over the past month, more than 500 people have died. Last week, President Karzai criticized the U.S.-led offensive. He said it was unacceptable that many Afghans had been killed in the fighting. He also said the current focus on hunting Taliban militants did not address the root causes of the violence. Karzai says he wants more emphasis on helping to rebuild the country's economy and strengthen its institutions. Condoleezza Rice traveled to Afghanistan from Pakistan, where she held talks with the Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf in Islamabad Tuesday. She urged Musharraf to cooperate more closely with Afghanistan against the Taliban. We're going to go now to Islamabad to speak with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's covered Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia for the past quarter of a century, is the author of three books, including Taliban and most recently Jihad, the Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He's just returned from a trip to Afghanistan. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. What is your assessment of the situation in Afghanistan right now from where you've just come out of?
It's very, very bleak on all sides. There has been a failure by the international community to deliver enough funding for reconstruction, enough troops for security. And this is something the Afghans have been warning about for a long time, 2 or 3 years. There's been a failure on the side of the Afghan government and President Karzai himself to show really effective leadership and to get rid of a lot of corrupt and drug-induced warlords who he's been ruling with. There has been also a failure of the neighboring states who continue to interfere, particularly the accusations that Pakistan has been harboring Taliban, which Karzai and most Afghans completely believe. So what we have now, of course, is this: we have two problems. We have a major insurgency in the south, where no longer is it just the case of hundreds of Taliban massing, but thousands of Taliban are now massing to take on the NATO and American forces in the south. And we have a failure of governance in Kabul, where the international community and Karzai have been blaming each other for this debacle.
I also wanted to ask you about the journalist Hayatullah Khan, the Pakistani journalist who was kidnapped and most recently his body turned up and he was found dead. What he was reporting on, what the allegations are by those who know about those reports and what the Pakistani government is responding.
Well, you know, that has been a really a tragic case that, in fact, is just part of the ongoing situation in the border regions. The Pakistan Army has moved into the tribal border regions of North and South Waziristan 2 years ago in order, really at the behest of the United States, in order to try and get Al-Qaeda and Taliban and other extremists who are hiding out there. They failed to really get anyone so far. There has been enormous bloody conflict. That whole region has been Talibanized. That is, the Pakistani tribes are becoming increasingly Talibanized and are demanding that the army withdraw so that they can declare an Islamic State. Now, in that process, the media has also been ousted, both by the Taliban and by the military. The military have insisted that the local stringers and journalists there report exactly what they say and don't report, you know, the truth or anything they might see. And so what has happened over the last 2 years is that most journalists have actually fled, or they've been forced to flee the region. And all we get now, the area is off limits to journalists, and all we get are handouts by the military. Now, in this situation, Hayatullah really was trying to report. I mean, the incident he was reporting was the fact that the Pakistan Army was saying that they had launched an attack some months ago, last year, against an Al-Qaeda Taliban stronghold with helicopter gunships. In fact, it was he proved that the attack was launched by American missiles, coming in from Afghanistan, which, of course, then created a political furor in Pakistan, because a lot of people then asked why the Americans are shelling Pakistani territory. So, I mean, he has really been punished for that. And his family have accused the military and the intelligence services of doing away with him. The military, of course, denies it. But there is no doubt that, reporting from that part of the world now is becoming almost impossible.
We're talking to Ahmed Rashid, Pakistani journalist, who is talking to us from Islamabad. His latest book is Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. We're going to break for 60 seconds and then come back and continue speaking with Ahmed Rashid and also Christian Parenti, correspondent for The Nation magazine, who also recently returned from Afghanistan, spending time with the Taliban. Stay with us. Casino Nation, Jackson Brown here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Ahmed Rashid on the line with us from Islamabad. We are also joined in our Firehouse studio by Christian Parenti, correspondent for The Nation magazine, has reported extensively from Afghanistan. He was most recently there in February and March, where he spent weeks meeting with and interviewing Taliban fighters. Can you talk about your experience there and this issue of the rise of the Taliban, Christian?
Well, as you said, I didn't spend weeks with the Taliban. I did an interview with them during one day, but what was the question?
The rise of the Taliban. You also were embedded with European troops in Afghanistan.
Yes, and U.S. troops. The reason the Taliban is on the rise is because of the failure of the U.S. occupation. And I think the fundamental background fact is that the Bush administration used Afghanistan as a stepping stone for Iraq. So that infected their occupation of Afghanistan in every way. They spent too little money, they sent too few troops, and they, in the interest of establishing quick stability or the appearance of stability, allowed the worst of the worst warlords to take over the government of Afghanistan, which is now really just a kleptocracy and just a ramshackle mess. So there's also been the standard sort of corruption in contracting that we've seen in Iraq. So the poor Pashtun people in the south of Afghanistan, where the Taliban is strongest, have a legitimate critique of the of their government, of the Karzai government, that it is corrupt and that it is immoral. Their solution to that is, you know, the Taliban version of an Islamic State. So that's the fundamental problem, is the failure of this occupation to create anything like a just government that is free of corruption and trying to achieve development.
And in the day that you interviewed Taliban fighters, what did they say?
They said that they were very clear about being based in Pakistan, about getting support from the ISI. So I don't think that's a theory. I think that, that Pakistan is playing both sides of the fence. They pretend to be the indispensable ally to the U.S. in the war on terror, and General Musharraf has achieved remarkable rehabilitation by playing this role. He's had sanctions removed, he's had aid increased, he's had his plebiscite recognized as something legitimate. But at the same time, Pakistan is pursuing a traditional agenda of trying to keep Afghanistan weak. Part of this has to do with the fact that the Pashtun areas are divided by the Pakistan Afghan border, the Durand Line, and in Afghanistan has always been controlled by Pashtuns to this day. So the last thing Pakistan wants is a strong Pashtun-governed state, while in Pakistan the Pashtuns are an impoverished and restive minority. So it behooves Pakistan, for other reasons as well, there are undammed rivers and flowing from Afghanistan into Pakistan. Pakistan dominates Afghanistan's markets. The Pakistani intelligence and military have written and spoken openly about wanting to use Afghanistan as strategic depth or fallback room in case there's a land war with India. So they never abandoned this traditional agenda, 50-year-long, really, agenda of trying to control and keep Afghanistan weak. But they just pretend that they have. So that's the Taliban fighters that I met and the spokesman that I interviewed later were very clear that they operate out of Pakistan and with the support of elements of Pakistani intelligence.
Ahmed Rashid, your response from Islamabad and also Condoleezza Rice going to Pakistan and now in Afghanistan.
Well, I think there's no doubt that Condoleezza Rice was in Pakistan to try and get, you know, perhaps further reassurances from President Musharraf that Pakistan would not aid and abet the Taliban from Balochistan province. And winning back the confidence of President Karzai, who has been scathing of America in recent weeks, partly because of America's silence on this whole issue of Pakistan aid the Taliban. I think she has tried to get some kind of commitment from Musharraf. She's probably taken that commitment to Karzai and said, you know, certain things will now happen. I think we still have to see what kind of pressure the Americans really can put on Pakistan. We should remember, I mean, the Americans are bogged down in Iraq. There's no conclusion in Iran. Everybody in this part of the world is seeing America as extremely weak, as extremely powerless. So if you have your own local agenda, if you have an extremist agenda, this is the time that you can snub the Americans and you know, tell them to go home, because they're not in a position to do anything. And I think people in the States don't really understand how weakened America does encourage, unfortunately, it does encourage, you know, enormous instability, because people feel that there is no check on what they want to do, particularly military dictators and other such.
And this issue of the Pakistani government, the military, the intelligence supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan, destabilizing Hamid Karzai.
Well, you know, the Afghans have offered enormous evidence of that, and certainly when I was in Kabul just now, NATO and the Americans, military officials, talked very conclusively about the fact that Pakistan does have a double agenda. It has an agenda of officially supporting Karzai and the international community in Afghanistan, and it has another agenda of supporting the Taliban. And the reason it gives for that is partly to keep Afghanistan weak, but another major reason the government is doing this is because it says that India has established an enormous presence in Afghanistan and is threatening and funding insurgencies in Pakistan on from the Afghan side of the border. Certainly India has come back into Afghanistan after more than a decade when it was ousted during the Mujahideen and the Taliban period. But there is now this kind of proxy war going on between India and Pakistan, which of course has gone on for the last 50 years on the eastern border in Kashmir and other places. Now it is taking place on Pakistan's western border as well.
There was a report, Christian Parenti, from the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about Afghanistan as a failed state by many of the indicators of a state around issues of poverty, etc., that it's one of the worst in the world.
Indeed. It ranks, I think, 174th on all those indicators from 100 at the bottom being 178. And the security situation has deteriorated very radically in the last several months. It's no longer possible for Westerners to drive safely from Kabul to Kandahar. So and there's also reports that Pashtun communities in the north of Afghanistan are also now have Taliban activity in them. So it's a total disaster. And there's a hope by the Europeans, who are picking up a lot of the slack, that they can do a better job than the Americans. And they claim they're better at counterinsurgency. But I fear that the situation is really beyond that, and that the cancer of the Taliban is set in too deep. And the money that's been spent so far has been wasted. And I think what has to happen is there has to be like a radical restructuring of the Afghan government. There are 32 ministries. It has to be constricted, and there has to be a real commitment to ending corruption. There, U.S. forces, when I was with them, I was shocked at how little they knew. Soldiers around Bagram, who were responsible for securing that valley, were being attacked in some villages and not others, and it's a mixed area between Tajiks and Pashtuns. And the lieutenant in charge of this group didn't know the ethnicities of different villages and didn't know that there might be some sort of political explanation that went along with that as to why they were being attacked in what were actually Pashtun villages and not in Tajik villages. So the whole thing is in utter shambles.
Ahmed Rashid, what would happen if the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan?
Well, clearly, you know, it would be a disaster simply because others would follow suit. I mean, right now you've got a situation where NATO and very large European contingents of troops are in fact replacing the Americans, and there is the threat that in fact the Americans are going to withdraw something like 3,000 out of its 19,000 troops by the end of this year. Now, that has sent shudders down the backs of the Afghan government, of President Karzai, who are very fearful of an American withdrawal, because it would really mean that even NATO, the European Union, the United Nations, all the other major bodies which are in Afghanistan, are either providing troops or money, would also reduce their presence. It's a fact of life in this part of the world that if the U.S. goes, then almost everybody else follows suit. And that's what is really worrying. And, you know, we should note that Condi Rice today in Kabul has actually made a great pitch for saying, we are not leaving, we are here to stay, we will see this through, we will support Karzai to the end, etc., etc. And that is really to reassure the Afghans that the U.S. is not just about to leave. But the signals are very different. I mean, the signals coming from the Defense Department are that the U.S. wants to pull out some troops. It wants to cut funding from the DOD. What has been, I think, totally criminal, that is the Rumsfeld informed Karzai several months ago that the Afghan army, which the Americans are training and funding, would not be as large as originally planned. They would get fewer weapons, and that from this year on, the Afghan government, which has absolutely no money, should be paying the salaries of the troops rather than the Americans, who have been paying the salaries for the last 2 years. Now, you know, I mean, in the midst of a Taliban offensive, for Rumsfeld to say something like that is not much of a morale booster if you're an Afghan soldier or an Afghan general.
Final word on this issue, Christian Parenti.
Well, it's, you know, I didn't support the invasion of Afghanistan, but I take no pleasure whatsoever in seeing this occupation fall apart. I think that the long-term effects of a collapse of Afghanistan will be disastrous for that region. And So people do need to you know, hopefully prevent that, and basically there a lot of money has to be invested, and there has to be a complete rethink of how everything by aid agencies, by the Pentagon, is done. But I don't see any chance of that happening under the Bush administration, because they are obsessed with and stuck in Iraq, and everything is hostage to that fantasy.
Christian Parenti, correspondent for The Nation magazine, just returned from Afghanistan in March. Ahmed Rashid, Pakistani journalist, talking to us from Islamabad. His latest book is Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. And that does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Maté, Frank Lopez, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston. Tonight, I'll be at NYU Vanderbilt Hall talking about state secrets. And on Friday night, we'll be at Ulster Community College. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy.